Okay, this is Cameron McCune and Bob Dobbs once again, and this is our 30th episode. And we're continuing to analyze my book, which is titled What We/You Didn't Know About Trump. All right, and we did the ending of the book the past 10 episodes, analyzing the interview, my interview with the tech body. Now we jump to the beginning of the book, now that we know the punchline, and I went through my first statement on Don Trump, President Trump, in the spring of 2017, and I brought in McLuhan's pattern of two approaches to art, the cathartic and the cognitive. And we discussed that, and now Cameron has some more thoughts about that part, and it's actually page... It's page one of the book. If you want to see the section on the cognitive...
No, it's page six of the book, the start of the fourth section.
Page four, how President Don Trump has become the first executive political leader to put on the shamanic tradition.
Right. So we talked about the shamanic tradition. By the way, you were always using the American pronunciation, shaman.
Yes.
And I was using the English pronunciation, shaman, but they're the same thing.
Good.
I complimented you on the idea of using these two schools to explicate another way of looking at Trump.
Yes, and it's actually page four in my book. Has the title.
Oh, okay. So I'm sorry. We always get mixed up between the pages of the book and the PDF pages.
Oh, yeah.
So, yes, it's page four in the what can be called the print. But at any rate, we agree it starts how President Don Trump has become the first executive political leader to put on the shamanic tradition.
Right. Now you can begin
Correct.
To say what your response to what we said last week.
Okay, good. Well, so I think it's very interesting what you do by saying that you want to use the cognitive point of view. What you point out is that unlike the ethical view, it does not have hostility to discontinuity, and it does not have indifference to all popular art. That's a reference to the quotation right at the start of page four that you take from a Joyce essay at the start of Interior Landscape.
Yes.
So once it is understood that discontinuity is fine and the analysis of popular art is also fine, then that gives an interesting approach to Trump, which you're going to take.
Yes.
So I think that's an excellent idea.
Great.
However, the problem is that you, on page five, when you're talking about the two schools, the ethical and the moral, and the other is cognitive and technical, you say one is sort of conceptual. This is the third line of page five. One is sort of conceptual, the ethical view, and then the cognitive approach is perceptual. Now, the problem with this is that there is not, for McLuhan at least, there is nothing that is not already perceptual. The difference between different types of experience is not that one can lack perception and another one can have it. It is that some, or indeed most, of experience cover over their percepts with concepts. So it's we don't want to start off on what you're doing by correlating ethical and moral with what McLuhan calls conceptual, and cognitive and technical with what he calls perceptual.
Yeah, the he doesn't do, does he do that?
No, no,
right.
He wouldn't do that because for McLuhan, what he calls vertical and horizontal experience,
yeah.
Or what he calls conceptual conceptual versus ethical, these are dualisms that he ultimately rejects.
All right. What I did is I took terms he wrote in the early 50s, ethical and moral versus cognitive technical, and I overlaid 60s terms, conceptual and perceptual. And you're saying that's a mistake.
Yeah, but it's even, but it, he may not use conceptual and perceptual in the early 50s, but he's already well aware that all dualisms are Gutenbergian.
Yeah, right.
So it's not the case that he wants to go about saying one view is right and the other view is wrong. It's just, these are two examples of experience, both of which may be analyzed more deeply. That said, to take one of them and to say that it's an interesting approach to Trump is an excellent idea. Right?
Right.
It's just that we don't want to mix it up with McLuhan's ultimate position.
Right. So he does all kinds of dialectics or doubles, commercial
Correct.
Versus non-commercial, visual versus acoustic. He does that in his work,
Correct.
His later work, once he gets into Gutenberg Galaxy and understand media. Now, people read that and they take them as opposites, right? They get into a dualism.
Correct.
Why do you think that he's putting on the dualism?
Well,
what they think is dualism, and they don't get that it isn't.
There you go. That's exactly the point. If McLuhan is read deeply, then he doesn't do dualisms. He explicitly rejects them. However, when people bring their normal style of reading to McLuhan, and this is, in my view, this is how McLuhan has only been read thus far, then he's seen to be not only a dualist, but he's seen to be some sort of historicist.
Yeah.
He's seen to be himself a Gutenbergian figure.
Right?
Yeah. It's ridiculous. So the point of what I'm trying to point out in your book here is not something against your book. I'm simply trying to make the all-important point that in reading McLuhan, we should never take a dualism as definitive.
Yeah.
We need to see him making a point about experience that is ultimately going to be undermined by McLuhan's own explication.
Why? Because it's, you read it?
I'm not understanding you there.
It undermines his explication because you're reading it. You get it by a book or an article. So then you start subliminally doing the dualism.
Yeah, that's an interesting point that in a book, each letter comes after the one before and the lines go chronologically and it's all black and white. So in a certain way, McLuhan is constrained by that.
Yeah.
And the whole point of what he is trying to do is to kind of work against the current.
Yep.
And that working against the current is actually what defines the great figures of the tradition.
Yes.
So when Plato, for example, is in his dialogues, has Socrates talking to various people in various settings, one of the things that's going on is Plato is trying to use the seemingly chronological dialogue form to get away from that seeming chronology.
Yeah.
And it's a very difficult knot, K-N-O-T, to point out and to unravel.
Yeah.
And you could say that the whole tradition is the attempt to get that K-N-O-T knot figured out, how to submit ourselves to it instead of either misseeing it or not seeing it at all or denying it or something like this, to try to figure out our relationship to that K-N-O-T.
Right. Do you think Zen attempts to do that or is successful in doing it, getting out of the knot?
I didn't hear your first word. Do I think
Zen? Zen Buddhism.
Oh, well, I mean, Zen Buddhism, like everything, is not one thing.
Yeah.
So some insights in Zen are do that superlatively. Others get into some sort of Gutenbergian explication and don't work.
Okay, so are those ones that are read? That's Zen that's read and not done in the oral method of the monastery?
No, that's not the case. What you're pointing out is more an illustration of the problem. It's not the sort of the end of the problem. I think it's the seventh letter. I could have the number wrong, but I think it's the seventh letter of Plato. He says that this is a doctrine which cannot be shared in writing, can only be shared orally between someone who knows and somebody who wants to learn it. And that's the distinction you're making.
Yeah.
But the tradition since Plato's time and starting in Plato's time, has largely been written. And in those 2,500 years, there's been many, many great figures who were not automatically limited just because they were writing.
Mm.
They saw great things, but they were unable to communicate it. And so then when McLuhan starts off in the 1930s and 40s, the problem that he has is not only to try to sort of figure things out, like any person in his 20s and early 30s, but he also is clear that one of the great problems in the tradition is precisely communication, that things that have been seen have been lost all the time. So he had these two problems to figure out, right? What do I know and how do I know it? And Kantian questions. And secondly, if I do figure something out, how can I say it? How can I communicate it?
Yeah.
And I don't know that up until now, we can say that he didn't succeed in communicating because none of the McLuhanites get it. And that's what I'm trying to do, and that's one of the things you say you're doing in your book.
Yes. So did anybody do both, get it and communicate it among the greats?
No. And that's the cul-de-sac in which we're in.
Yes. And that may be inevitable. I think you've said that.
The non-communication?
The cul-de-sac that we're in is always there, always been there, and we don't get out of it. Do you go that far?
Yes, I would go that far, but the cul-de-sac, which is always there, is not always there exclusively. It's not alone there. Also, the solution is there. But between the cul-de-sac and the solution, there is a gap.
Yeah.
And that's a resonating gap, but it's a gap which, if humans are to survive, we need to cross. But we need to cross it in a way that doesn't just go from one side to the other.
Right.
Which would be just one more dualism. Right? So the we could say that we need to see the benefit or the promise or the gift of the cul-de-sac. And when that is seen, then we're out of it.
Right. Now, do you feel you've done that and are communicating it?
Well, no in both of your questions.
Right.
But you are
criticizing it or pointing out the problem. And did everybody of the greats point out the problem?
Yes.
Okay.
The only difference is today our situation is much more dangerous and much more fragile just because of atomic weapons and their increasing spread around the world.
Right. So is that a new wrinkle to the cul-de-sac that McLuhan was just pointing out? It was kind of obvious that
I'm not sure I understand. Are you saying that the new wrinkle was obvious but not seen, something like that?
Okay, the new wrinkle is that we can wipe ourselves out. Everybody talked about that or did since 1945.
Yes.
Did McLuhan find a different way to talk about what was obvious? That this was different. The world could blow itself up. That didn't seem to be possible before, and now we're in this new situation. Was that the only newness that McLuhan was communicating?
Oh, not at all. Not at all. Like you say, or as you say, there were many people, in fact, almost the whole intellectual world, when the United States dropped those two bombs, the whole intellectual world was shocked.
Right.
And thought that everybody thought that we were into a new era that had broken with all of previous history.
Right. Now, he then writes pretty quickly in the Southern Quality about that situation in the first couple of pages of that article.
Right.
Is he saying something different than what Bertrand Russell or somebody would be saying?
Yes, because... for McLuhan, the danger was not definitive, and it's the difference between sort of the automatic nihilism of the modern world is that it sees the danger as definitive and sees no way out of it, and that's the cul-de-sac. Whereas McLuhan always saw the danger as not as being definitive, and he saw the especially the Catholic Church as having a kind of counter answer to the danger, but he was, especially in the late 1940s, he was increasingly conscious that he didn't know how to express that properly.
Right. So was he the only one seeing something?
No, I don't think so. I think, for example, I'm doing a lot of work on T.S. Eliot at the moment.
Yeah.
And Eliot's four quartets, which were sort of written between 1935, I think, was Burnt Norton. And Little Gidding, the last of the quartets, was published during the war, maybe in 1943 or 40. Yeah. So McLuhan, when he was struggling with how to say things properly, was intensely involved with the four quartets.
Yes.
He and Hugh Kenner were reading them very closely.
And with both, the intention of doing a book, I think. At some
yes,
point.
Together.
Yeah.
That's right. And then instead of that, both of them published on Eliot in 1948, 49, 50, and 51.
Yeah.
And in 51, Kenner even published a book on Eliot.
Yes. Okay, so is McLuhan seeing something that others aren't seeing?
Well, in a way,
yes. Period, in this period, after 45,
uh-huh.
Why is McLuhan going to become a phenomenon in the 50s and 60s? If he's dealing with the same cul-de-sac everybody else is dealing with.
Yeah, well, that's a difficult question because a lot of it has to do with technological developments, especially with TV, and it also has to do with a kind of depression that got into the educationalists who increasingly saw that schooling wasn't working.
Yeah.
The technical developments plus the educational problems were both very important to the National Association of Educational Broadcasters, and it was with them that McLuhan developed his characteristic. That's right.
Yeah.
Well, I would say not his prominence, because his report for them was issued in 1960, and it would be another 5 or 6 years before he became prominent.
Yes.
But what he did do with the National Association of Educational Broadcasters was develop the notion that there was a way of talking about our problems in education especially, but also problems in business and politics, which could be put in technological terms or the terms of new media.
Yeah.
And it was that combination which then led to his prominence.
Right. So was he, Plato, you know, famously quotes the statement by Thoth that writing will, the pharaoh, I guess, the king, says writing will create
uh-huh.
forgetfulness. That's sort of trying
yeah.
to talk about the problem of communication, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
So did somebody say that about the printing press, the way Plato did it and the way McLuhan did it later?
Do you mean somebody in between Plato?
Yeah,
and
like
at
time of Shakespeare, did someone point out the problem of medium? The problem.
Yeah,
of,
well, I think so. I think that's exactly what Innes did. Innes.
No, I mean at the time of the printing press.
Oh, back then.
Yeah.
I don't think so. But that would I would have to give that some thought. I don't think that there were people until the 20th century. Well, no, let's maybe Mallarmé or maybe
Nietzsche.
I'm not so sure that Nietzsche saw the problem with printing per se. Nietzsche is definitive when it comes to the characterization and problems of the Gutenbergian perspective, but he doesn't trace it to Gutenberg.
Right. He's aware of the medium problems. Or what is he aware of?
Yeah, he's aware of the fact that Gutenbergian perception leads to nothing.
Right.
He realizes that there's no foundation there, that it leads to nothing, to nihilism, and that nihilism cannot help but pervade society. And when it pervades society, it will then lead to universal war. And he was right in all of that.
Yeah.
Right? Nietzsche is especially interesting in his analysis of morality, because what he says there is that the human being is a moral animal. He, the human being cannot get away from morality. And so when all morality falls through itself into nothing, that doesn't mean that the animal will cease to be moral. Mm. It just means that the animal will attempt to find morality where it can't be found. And the whole problem of modernity for Nietzsche, and I think he's right, is that human beings will use morality to justify war, to justify mind control, to justify all of the worst evils that human beings are capable of, and it will call them moral. And there's where we are today.
Right. I overheard McLuhan saying to a professor on a Monday night that Nietzsche studied the effects. Is that too superficial a statement to put any weight into it, that Nietzsche was doing?
No, that's an excellent statement. As I was saying before, I don't think Nietzsche talks very much about print as a cause, and McLuhan may have been thinking of that. Mm. But for McLuhan, there's nothing wrong with talking about effects. For McLuhan, that's the way you do things.
But he is proposing a science of causes.
Yes, but it's what you do is you interrogate effects and then try to come up with causes. Personally, I don't think that McLuhan was all that great in defining causes and defining the investigations that the exposure of causes would enable.
Well, because he named TV as a cause and radio as a cause of World War II, people were struck by that. They had not thought of that. So
correct.
He was original in pointing out new causes, but whether he was successful in communicating what that meant is what you're wondering about or can question.
Well, partially that, but in the examples you just gave, McLuhan's getting in his own way.
Hmm.
As Eliot says, I have to use words to communicate with you.
Yeah.
And McLuhan is using found objects, namely television and radio, as if they could be causes. It's a little bit like somebody holding up a gold bar and saying, this is an element. No, a gold bar is not an element. A gold bar is composed of an element, namely gold.
Hmm.
But the gold bar is not an element. An element is something completely different. And similarly with radio and TV, these are not causes. These are the effects of causes. And by talking about them as if they were causes, McLuhan is getting in his own way. But on the other hand, how to talk about media as causes is very, very difficult. And maybe you have to talk about radio and TV as they're found in a home in order to try to get people to think about media at all.
Yeah.
But that's the problem of communication. That's exactly why we've had 2,500 years of brilliant people not being able to communicate what they were seeing.
And what did you just say about radio and TV in the home? Might have missed that.
Well, that those are found objects.
Yeah.
They are not the same as the underlying media which enabled them. Right, it's the difference between the gold bar and gold as elements that I was talking about a minute ago.
So what enabled radio and TV? What underlying elements enabled them?
Digitality, the electricity.
Yeah.
The form that enables a newspaper, telegraph. It turns out that it's a form that even enables language, but it's a form that we were largely unconscious of for thousands of years, even though we were exemplifying it. So everybody was going around talking, but they didn't understand what they were doing. And they didn't understand it because in their attempt to understand it, they would take a Gutenbergian perspective in which the ontology had to be singular. It had to come to a point. So you had to try to explain language, let's say, in terms of a point. And that was ridiculous because language is inherently dialogical. So it's only with the development of electrical devices that human beings begin to understand how something can be fundamental and plural. Electricity gives human beings that vision, right? That bipolar, back and forth vision that they didn't have before. And so now they can begin to understand something like language or something like reality as if these things could be plural, that is to say gapped, but not dualistic. And that's, for McLuhan, that's a great thing.
Right. Now, what about the thinkers who fail to understand their communication bias or structure before the printing press? You wouldn't call them Gutenbergian. What would you call them?
Why not? They can be called Gutenbergian because what Gutenberg did was kind of amplify literacy. So from 400 BC, let's say, when literacy was beginning to become general, in effect, you have Gutenberg already. And indeed, if you say with McLuhan that all is always now, there's all at onceness, then the Gutenbergian form of experience is a perpetual possibility. We can imagine lots of people in caves or in tribal societies who were sort of literal in their experience or in their expression prior to there being literacy as letters.
Right. So the Gutenberg effect is not tied to writing. Any kind of writing?
No, ultimately not. That's the same thing that we were saying about radio and TV in the house. That's exactly right. All writing is an example of something deeper than writing.
Is this what Derrida was trying to get at with his idea of text?
Maybe. I don't like to talk about Derrida because there is a huge amount of the guy's work that I haven't read, and I'm not particularly interested in reading it. But when, for example, Derrida criticizes McLuhan as trying to go back into orality, and then Derrida says, yeah, but there's only text, and so McLuhan is kind of a dreamer, and he doesn't really know what he's talking about. But what Derrida did not understand in McLuhan is that orality was not a kind of an exclusive ontological goal that McLuhan was setting out. Instead, McLuhan was trying to say that orality is a possibility for human beings, but at the same time, so was textuality. And so what McLuhan was interested in was the transitive gap between those two, whereas what Derrida seems to me, from limited amount of reading I've done of him, he sees the same contrast but does not see a transitive gap between them. He sees a non-transitive gap, which then leads him to say that everything is text.
What does transitive mean there?
Transitive, dialogical.
Okay.
Back and forth, transformative,
right,
in McLuhan's language.
How is transitive used in grammar? Transitive verbs, I think it is.
Yes, there's transitive verbs and intransitive, and transitive verbs are ones that relate a subject to an object. That is what transitive means. It means relational. And intransitive verbs do not relate to an object. They can only have indirect objects.
Right. Okay, so did you, in your trips to Europe, didn't you go to a Derrida seminar and met him?
No, I didn't. I went many times to a seminar in Italy where Derrida had talked previous to when I was there, but I've never met Derrida. I've been to lectures by Derrida, but I've never met the man personally.
Right, but you were in the audience.
Yes, but not there, not when I was in Europe. The only times that I heard Derrida were in the United States, and one in New York and one in Chicago.
Right. Would you, if you had an opportunity, stood up at the end and asked a question?
Maybe, but I found when I went to philosophical meetings and would stand up and ask questions, generally I was beaten down as being a business person. I would be the only person who was a quote-unquote businessman at the conference or in the seminar or something like that, and people hated the fact that I was there, and they wouldn't let me ask questions.
Were friends of yours? How did they know you were a businessman?
Well, sometimes they were people that knew me, and sometimes they were people who just had some idea about me from rumor. But it was in most of these conferences, very, very unusual for a business guy to be there.
Right.
And even worse, a business guy to ask questions that they weren't sure of the answer.
That they weren't sure of the answer. Is that what you just said?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so the most of them were professors?
Are you meaning professors
in the audience?
In terms of, yeah, but do you mean professors in terms of rank or professors just as a general term for academics?
Yeah, academics. Were they academics?
Oh, they're 100%. 100% academics.
And so they were suffering the Gutenberg illusion. They were non-McLuhanites. They believed in that dialectic or duality between business and thinking or whatever they thought they were doing.
Oh, for sure. For sure that was the case. But that was largely kind of unthought. I think generally it was considered that I was kind of butting into affairs that I shouldn't be butting into.
Did anybody speak to you after, when they're schmoozing, the lecture's over?
Absolutely. So there were famous people that were very kind to me. They would come up and they would say, that was a very good question, but most of these people don't get it. Because, at these conferences, there can be, 100 people, let's say, and, 98 of them are careerists.
Yeah.
They really don't think. They don't have a calling. They're there to kind of rub off on the fame of a few people that are there who do think, and they're there to make connections.
Yeah.
So they can publish their papers or whatever.
Yeah, it's practical. They're the business people. They're in
right.
it for the business.
That's correct. That is absolutely correct.
Right.
And so if there's an explicit business person there, then,
The ground. You're the ground.
Yeah. Well, it certainly reminds them of what they're doing and what they don't want to admit they're doing.
And so the more of our famous ones would be polite and acknowledge you and say it was a good question and put everybody else down. Well, they don't understand what your question's about. But he wouldn't say, because you're a businessman, they wouldn't go that far, right?
No, of course not. But, you know, anybody that actually thinks doesn't characterize people as a academic or a business guy or something like that. It's more of a question of does this person know what he or she is talking about or not?
Yeah, it's you're interested in what you're trying to communicate or understandable communication. The color, the clothing is irrelevant. You're actually looking at their mind and through the eyes, probably, and see if they respond to you. And
that's right. So just as a good example, I was at a conference, I think it was around 1980. It was actually quite a famous conference on hermeneutics in Kansas, University of Kansas in Lawrence. And there were people from all over the world there. So it was a big conference, and that's where I met John O'Neill, for example, from York.
Yeah.
And John was one of the people that was very kind and sort of considerate and a little bit apologetic for how
you having wandered into the wrong place.
That's right. But the I would say one of the big stars was Paul DeMann.
Who I know you mean.
Yeah. So, and he was a friend, a very close friend of Derrida.
Yes.
At one point, DeMann came up to me and said, that was an interesting question. We should, have a drink or something like this.
Yeah.
And he was for the whole conference, he was very kind to me. And then we had the same ride going from Lawrence over to Kansas City to get our flights out of there. And so DeMann, I thought, was a very thoughtful, very kind guy, and I liked him.
Even though he was a Nazi.
At one point in his life, he had certainly worked with the Nazis and written stuff that they found acceptable for sure.
Yeah. His career ended in a bit of a scandal that was unfair, you'd say?
Well, I don't know if it was unfair, but his the man could not be defined simply in terms of what he did during the Second World War. He also had to be seen as a man who became friends with people like Derrida and had great insight into hermeneutics.
Yeah. Hey, here's an interesting side point. It was in Lawrence, Kansas, that Ion showed up.
I thought he was in Georgia or someplace like
well,
that.
Well, J.W., the man in Georgia, in Atlanta, met Carol and I in Lawrence, Kansas, because we were visiting a female professor there who claimed she had a cold fusion device. And so
that was funny.
Yeah, it was an interesting encounter for a few days. A lot of strange things happened. But we flew back to Maui. We had just gotten there a couple months before. This is in October 2008. And he flew back to Atlanta. And then the next day called Carolyn, or me, whoever answered, and said he has to write something because all these ideas are flooding in his head. And he didn't know where they were coming from, but he thought he should write it down, even though he wasn't a writer. And later we found out that that was the beginning of Ion impressing on his brain.
But why was this guy from Georgia in Lawrence, Kansas?
He was a billionaire, and he was going to buy or invest in the thing if the woman could convince him it was real.
Oh, I see. So he was there for the same reason that you were.
Yes, we were all there to, we arranged, I had found out about her accidentally, and I told him 6 to 8 months before that. And he thought, yes, let's go see her. And that required 6 months of preparation of his travel itinerary because he needed a lot of security. And
so, how had you met him in the first place?
Carolyn had gone to Atlanta in the summer, August, September 2005, to see a medical friend. And these people, I think I've said this in previous episodes, these people were part of they were Christians, and they would do some kind of crazy Christian thinking and go to Las Vegas and gamble. And with their Christian thinking, they would do well. And so it was kind of a superstitious cult. But Carolyn didn't know anything about that. She went down to see her friend, and her friend took her to a meeting of the cult. And J.W. was asked, because he was known locally as a billionaire and an expert on banking and money, he was asked to take care of their winnings or to invest in the Iraqi dinar. So he wasn't engaged in the cult, but he was the guy that would interview everybody to see if they were acceptable to be in it. So Carolyn was thrown into an interview with him. That was interesting. You know, he interviewed Carolyn, but Carolyn wasn't trying to be in the cult, but it was just an odd, you know, confluence of situations. So she came back to New York on City Island, and two or three months later, JW called her out of the blue and asked to speak to me because she had quoted me, probably some McLuhan stuff, to him. And he couldn't get it out of his mind, so he wanted to ask me what I meant. So we started talking, and I didn't know him, and we never stopped talking. We're still talking today, but I took him over. That was early 2006. And ION, we realized, it officially came through March 18th, 2009, but in October 22nd or so, in 2008, something happened there, and maybe he was feeling it the day before when he flew out, but it was right then, and he couldn't talk about what he was going through in his mind because he had to deal with this woman and her scene. So we did that, and basically the woman wasn't real, so we dropped it, and we went back to Maui, and he went to Georgia, and he called the next day or within a day or two to talk about what was happening in his brain, and we didn't know. So Carolyn said, well, I got more time here in Maui, say your stuff and I'll type it up. So he started dictating to Carolyn, and then shortly after that he would step out to his patio and he'd go into another world, literally transport into some weird place. And so that started to happen, so he would talk to us about it, but he was very nervous about talking to us about it because he was embarrassed, and he thought we might think he was a nut, but we didn't because we had gone to mediums before, but we didn't know he was channeling or anything, but we were interested in what someone was going through. The person wasn't ill. And then a couple months later, he started seeing 100 more ghosts in his home sitting around talking to him. Now, you remember me telling you this?
With the ghosts, you've come up to
what you remember.
You've talked about before, but everything prior to that, the whole from 2005 to 2008 or 9 or wherever you are now, you hadn't talked about that.
Oh, okay.
And the whole Lawrence connection is kind of amusing.
Yeah, I mean, you had a nice connection there, and I had a nice connection there. And you know, William Burroughs was living there.
Separated by 25 years.
Oh, is that what it was? 25 years?
Yeah, I was 1980.
In 1980,
I was there,
right.
You were 2005 or 6.
Yeah, and so Burroughs was living there, thinking of McLuhan's
article.
That's
right, he was there, yeah.
Yeah,
and Ginsberg was there for off and on.
Right, And Burroughs was shooting his paintings. That's how he made painting. He would shoot at the canvas. So we're there in 2005. I think he died in 96, 97. So he wasn't there in 2008. He had gone. But anyways, so because the ghosts were talking to him, I just had this crazy idea that the spirits called the Evergreens that were channeled through Michael Blake Reed, who I had a long experience with, were back because J.W. says to me, one of the ghosts said, say hi to Bob. And J.W. said, well, what? Who are you? What's going on here? And the ghost said, I'm Dr. Beter. And so J.W. called me up the next day and said, do you know Dr. Peter Beter? And I said, yeah. He died in March 87. I did a was involved in a gold deal with Buckingham Palace with Dr. Beter. And so JW said, well, these ghosts, he was among the ghosts. And I said, and that's when I got my brilliant idea. This is the original nutty idea. I said, oh, these are the ghosts that speak through Michael Blake Reed, who had stopped channeling them November 2004. And that was triggered by an event in the coach house that I was trying to have him do a session in the coach house. And people wanted to talk to McLuhan, and that didn't happen. And then he decided then to stop anyways. So this is four years later, and 4.5 years later, and I had the idea, these are the Evergreens. I'd spent many hours talking to them. So I said, let's get on the phone tomorrow, and I'll try to talk to the spirits in your home. And so we did that, and then one spirit started talking, what we thought was a spirit, and that turned out to be Ion. So that's how it started. But it began, in my experience of JW, it was the second time I met him. I met him in April 2007 at his home. He invited us there after me talking to him on the phone for a year. And then now this is the second time I meet him, and it's in Lawrence, Kansas, and that, in retrospect, is when he started to have this weird takeover of himself by whatever Ion is. So
let me get clearer about these Evergreens. I always had the impression up until now that the Evergreens were sort of on our side, and that you were channeling through them. But now it sounds like you're channeling to them.
Yeah, I'm not channeling. Michael Blake Reed.
Reed, yeah.
In August 1974, accidentally interrupted. He was sleeping in an office on St. Clair Avenue West near McLuhan's church. And somebody was on the phone talking. And Michael Blake Reed started talking to the person that the phoner was talking to. It was actually his mistress. And so the guy looks and says, what the heck? What, Michael's interrupting my phone call here. And he gets off the phone and starts talking to Michael, and Michael's asleep. And then Michael starts saying all these crazy things. So he gets the rest of the staff and people in the building to come in and talk to Michael. And they interviewed Michael, who remains asleep and is saying stuff. And then the voices they were talking to said, we're leaving. And then Michael woke up, and he's looking at these people staring at him, and he doesn't know what had happened. And when they told him, he didn't believe it. And so they said, we're going to do it again. So they arranged a few days later to sit him down, and they didn't, I don't know what they thought, how they make it happen, but they put him to sleep, or he went to sleep, and the spirits started talking to them. They didn't have names for him yet, and they recorded it. And so when it was over, Michael woke up. He said, okay, what bullshit happened this time? And they played the recording to him, and he was shocked. And so he left that building, which was actually teaching a Silva mind control. So it was a bit of a psychic environment happening there. And he went off and became a medium. He started doing it for people and charging money.
So I thought you were talking about the time that he stopped being
no,
a medium.
No, okay, that's so August 74. No, that's August,
yeah, okay.
So I'll have to finish this. So in August 74, he starts, August, September, and he goes for 30 years. He does 11,000 sessions in 19 countries, and the government, American government, used him. He's very famous for those that were into finding out about him. And years later, in 95, I discovered the Evergreens in 80 and started going to them regularly from 85 on. I had a five-year break after my first.
But did you say you discovered the Evergreens and started
I discovered Michael Blake Reed channeled the Evergreens on Q107 in Toronto. He was interviewed by a local talk show.
But notice, sometimes you say, I was going to the Evergreens as a short form of saying I was going to Michael Reed. And then through him to the Evergreens.
Yes. Well, I've said this story 4 million times. And usually it's around people who know what I'm referring to or something.
Right.
So
it's
shorthand. It's lazy. Uh-huh. Yes, I have to. It's not many new people I'm talking about, you know, talking to. So I got to be more particular. So anyways, I did a couple of sessions in 1980. And then I waited to see if this stuff came true. And it did. So I got back with them in 1985, and from that point on, I saw them at least once a year when they came to Toronto, or twice a year, because Michael moved from the Toronto area to Vancouver in 85. And he had met McClone in the 60s. He was an advertising executive in Toronto. He'd gone to a conference, and Bucky Fuller was there, and he met Bucky Fuller, and he spent like a whole evening late into the, you know, past midnight with McClone and a bunch of people in the hotel room. And so that was interesting that he knew who McClone was, because once I realized I could talk to dead people through Michael, the Evergreens would bring dead people, I started talking to McClone. But in 95... I call up Corinne, and I haven't talked to her in 13, 14 years, since I did the archives, and I don't remember why I called her up. I was going to go to the Evergreens, and I just thought I'd be friendly, because she had told me she used to talk to Marshall after he died in the kitchen. She told me that one night. And then I met a woman in New York who had met Corinne briefly, didn't know her, but Corinne told her about that. So it wasn't just said to me. So I knew Corinne was interested in, quote, the spiritual, or whatever you call this, communication. So I called up 95 and said, I'm going to be seeing the Evergreens. I explained who they are. And halfway through explaining who they are, she said, I know them. I've been to the Evergreens. That's what she said. And I said, okay, well, that's interesting. So I said, well, I'm going to be there tomorrow. And I talked to Marshall a lot. And I can say this stuff to her because she had told me she talked to him. And I said, do you have any questions for him? And she thought for a minute or so and said, no, I don't have any questions. So I didn't ask anything on her behalf. But 15 years later, around 2010, 95 to 2010, I'm involved with Mary McClune a lot and talking to her. And she one day tells me, I was looking through my stuff and I came across this folder. And it's something called the Evergreens. Didn't you know something about them? She remembered the name. And I said, yeah, that's the medium that your mother told me she went to. And she said, well, I have here the record of the family going to Michael Blake Reed and the transcripts of each kid's reading. And I don't know if Marshall was listed there. And she couldn't tell whether Marshall was there. But... she told me a bit about, without violating the privacy, told me what the report said. And she said, maybe I'll give you a copy someday, which she never did. But she had found this, and she had not gone to the Evergreens because she was in California. But she found out they had given her a copy of it, and it happened in 76. So here's McLuhan had overlapped with the Evergreens and Michael Blake Reed. So that was auspicious for my life. When people say, Bob, you're not claiming you talked to McClure through the Evergreens, I say, well, he did it himself. And back in 74, I don't know, Mary has, Ms. Corinne told me she did the Evergreens until 95. So in 74, I call up McLuhan, and I congratulate Eric's article on the Thunders in the James Joyce Quarterly, And then I mentioned that I was living on bananas, eating a lot of bananas for some crazy vegetarian. I became a fruitarian at one point. And so I was talking, and he said, as soon as I said, he said, no, that's not good. Edgar Casey says bananas are bad. He quoted Edgar Casey, for fuck's sake. Okay? You know who that is?
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a shock. What? This Catholic guy quoting a medium and following his dietary suggestions and telling me to watch out? Not good to live on bananas. So,
but he could well have been joking.
Was serious. Well, then when I met Don Thiel, he talked about they investigated mediums and everything all the time in the early 50s when he was a graduate student at Marshall. They would go around the corner to Bay and Queen or something, and there was a health food store there. This is in 51, 52, 53. And the guy had all these occult books for sale. And they would go there and buy books. And then Don, years later, gave me a list of all the occult books they studied. And a lot of them was medieval stuff, very obscure manuscript titles. They really went into it in depth as part of his looking into conspiracies and secret societies. Don's the only one who really did that with Marshall. So that confirmed his interest in that stuff. He seriously studied.
Oh, he definitely was interested.
Yeah.
There's a difference between being interested in something as a symptom or as a something to try to understand, a difference between that and following something.
Right. Well, like me, I don't follow anything. He was like me. He was investigating, but he was serious. He knew his stuff. He knew Casey. And of course, other people commented on how superstitious Marshall was. He wouldn't travel on a full moon or things like that. One of the older academics at the Fordham Conference in 98 did a whole paper on all of McLuhan's superstitions that he found out about. He listed them all off. So McLuhan had a lot, and people noticed them and communicated to this guy, so he did a paper on it. So it was not it was a surprise in 74, but later as I found out more and more about Marshall, with Don's help, I could see why he would quote Casey. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is all a digression because you brought up Lawrence, Kansas, and I'm telling you that it's interesting that in a way is where J.W. started to have this effect on him. And then later we realized that he was seeing ghosts and traveling to other dimensions and feeling all these ideas, is that he was beginning to, quote, channel. And so all this stuff was coming into his head, and maybe it pushed him into astral regions. So that all made sense once Iron showed up, what had been happening.
How do you think about that in terms of bodies? Him as having
My bodies is you have your physical or chemical body ruled by Western chemistry and knowledge, so I call it the chemical body. And then most cultures believe there's more than the physical, so I call that the astral body. The collective wisdom of culture is the astral body, astral archive. Then we added the TV body and the chip body, and then I figured there was stuff we didn't know at all, and I called that the mystery body. When Ion showed up, Ion learned about my five bodies from me, probably already knew it because it had ESP, but let me spell it out at some point. And they said, well, we're here to make the mystery body understandable. We're going to, I was calling it the mystery landscape. If I didn't know what it was a landscape. Once I knew more about it, it would be the mystery body. And so Ion said, we're going to make the mystery landscape, which you know nothing about. We're going to make you know a lot about it through us, because we're from the mystery landscape. And then you'll know and understand the mystery body. So later, I had a five-body situation. Before then, it was only four bodies. with the mystery landscape. But then I added mystery body once I learned a lot from Ion. So that's what the five bodies are.
Right, but the what I was trying to figure out is, so your friend J.W. is mostly or entirely in the astral body.
Yeah.
When he is acting as a medium, and what he communicates is then about the mystery body.
Yes.
Do I understand that right?
Yeah. You could say it's about the astral body, but there's a lot about the astral body that Ion tells us that no one knew before. Ion says this is the first time humans have talked to what Ion calls themselves non-physical, which is pretty amazing if that's true. And so there's a lot of new stuff about traditional astral body, theosophical knowledge, you know, or the Dalai Lama's knowledge, the different shamanistic knowledge, whatever you, however you come across it. Ion corrects a lot of it, tells us what's really going on, and that's why I've been talking to him for 31,000 hours.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. And a lot of brand new stuff. And so I would agree with you. I'd call Ion more than the astral body. It's the all the bodies and the mystery, especially. And then it all worked towards our products and our actual free electricity device. These are actual things that Ion made, told us how to make. That's the hexadic body, which is the sixth part of my tiny node chart. My tiny node chart is five levels anticipating hexadic. And it was inspired by the medical work that Carolyn did in New York in the early 90s and mid-90s with this technology that treated AIDS successfully. And it was an odd contraption made up of, you took a syringe needle and you put it in a little casement, and you would make an electric charge interact with the tip of the needle as you injected homeopathic remedies into acupuncture points. So combine acupuncture, homeopathy, herbs, would be herbal remedies, homeopathized or potentized, and electric magnetism or electricity or whatever you call that in this device. So herbs, homeopathy, acupuncture, and magnetic electric pulse. And it was an incredible thing. And I said, well, this is a new kind of device that regular science can't explain. And so I made the tiny node chart to express environmentally where we were coming to. And now we're going to come to the word electricity. But before I say that, I extrapolated this little invention into a sociological phenomenon, a new medium, and I called it the hexad, because the first five parts were monad, dyad, triad, tetrad, and pentad. I got the word pentad from Zingroni. And so I predicted the hexad, and that turned out to be a prediction of Ion showing up. And so we've been living with the hexadic, quote, body for 12 years, since 2009.
But all these bodies they're not things that come and go in historical time, right? I mean, they're perennially there, they're not always expressed, just like any element or any possibility.
Right. The TV and computer or digital body were expressed at some point in the big now, right?
By the way, you may hear the noise of a coffee machine here. I'm making myself a little coffee like I did last time.
Okay, so that whole thing about electricity, well, you know, half an hour ago, when I said, I got you to say that electricity is the common ground or cause. Remember that?
Yeah. Yeah, of course.
Well, that's what de Kirchhoff does. He'll say it's electricity, you know, that's causing all these weird new phenomena for humans since the telegraph. So he calls it electricity. He doesn't say TV radio. So maybe he's thinking of what you're thinking of, the ground itself.
Well, partly, but
What'd you say?
It's not wrong to see electricity as a ground, but it is wrong to see it as a culminating ground, as if it were able to trump other grounds. It's not. It's one possibility amongst other possibilities, and the point is not to see its triumph, but to see its see its place amongst other possibilities. And I think de Kirchhoff sees it as sort of a culmination rather than as one of a series of other possibilities.
Right, so you're saying that electricity doesn't trump the Gutenberg environment?
Correct. Correct. It does so in time, but the two of them are in all at onceness, as McLuhan would say.
Yeah. Okay, so we were discussing, the communication problem. So what is it that McLuhan did that others didn't do, and he failed to communicate it, or he didn't do anything, he just used modern words for his now, or from his now. It was the same Socratic dialogue.
Well, I mean, everybody speaks from their now or from the now.
Yeah.
Everybody speaks from possibilities in different senses, right? There's a language itself is a series of possibilities. And I get one of the things I think Finnegan's Wake is about is using language, being conscious of the underlying possibilities.
Yeah. Yes.
What McLuhan was doing in a certain way wasn't different from what other people were doing. He was trying to understand what being a living human being is all about, trying to understand what being a family man is all about, trying to earn enough money from universities to keep his family fed and clothed. All of that was fairly typical. But what was untypical about McLuhan and what he shared with lots of other people in the tradition, but not too many people that were contemporaneous with him, was that he could see solutions to problems which were enormous hang-ups in the world, hang-ups for people individually and hang-ups for whole societies and for nations.
Mm. He could see a solution.
That's right. That's right. He could see a solution, but he wasn't able to communicate it. Just as has happened throughout history.
Right. So he's inspired.
I would say so, yes.
Yeah. He did I did a lot of talking to him through the Evergreens or through Michael Blake Reed, and he'd come in and the Evergreens would feature him. And at one time he stressed, I would approach it as a media ecology and talk about media and whatever. And he said at one point, "This is a vision, Bob. I have a vision." That's what you're getting at there with when I say inspiration, right? He had a vision.
I think so, yes. People need to be careful that that's using vision in a different sense from Gutenbergian vision.
Yeah, right.
As opposed to some sort of musical vision or something.
No, he saw a solution. That's what the vision was.
Correct. That's right.
Yeah. And
that's how both Dante's Commedia and Eliot's Four Quartets both end with a vision.
Yeah, yeah. And You see, that's why I'm glad I went to this crackpot, Michael Blake Reed, pretending he was channeling Indies, because that idea here, you know, suspending disbelief and say, okay, I'm talking to a McLuhan spirit, and he says it was a vision. You never heard McLuhan say that, right? He never said, I have a vision. He avoided that kind of talk. So to hear him say it helped me see him differently. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Which led
sure.
push me in the right direction and understanding what you mean by saying he had a solution. Now,
right.
it's okay, so we're in this cul-de-sac. I'm trying to do something. I've had a vision of the tech body, but actually it was Ion that told me, but my vision is interacting with the reality of Ion, and he's pointing out the tech body, and I'm trying to explain it and what I see in mm-hmm. Trump. That's what's happening here. So I'm in the
yeah.
cul-de-sac, and we're going to hopefully go through this and figure out if I did get something communicated.
Mm-hmm.
With the proviso
yeah, so we're
that nobody succeeded. With the proviso, nobody succeeded so far.
Right, right.
And then what
so
you say?
Kind of on, we're on parallel tracks, you could say.
Yeah.
That we both see that a kind of communication is a great need in the contemporary world. And
yes.
that...
we feel we could do it,
right? or at least, in my case, I don't say that I could do it. I say that I'm called to attempt it.
Yeah,
and I hope that I can do it.
Right, and I'm in the same boat,
right.
And I'm actually more public than you in the electric now. You're
yeah, much more.
No, none of you on the electric now, but you've written a lot, and a lot of people are reading your work, so they get you that way. So we're in opposite, I guess, opposite media, right?
That's true. Although I don't think it's true to say a lot of people are reading my stuff. I think almost no one.
Do you have a way of knowing who clicks on your site?
No, I don't. I should try to set that up. It is certainly possible.
Well, if there were 100 people reading it, 2 have communicated to you, right? They're not telling you.
Yeah, well, you know, I know that people read my stuff now and again.
Right.
When stuff about McLuhan is questioned in Google, it's my stuff frequently comes up. Google seems to like my stuff.
At the top?
Yes.
Wow. Well, that's pretty neat.
Well, maybe.
Wow.
It's hard to say. Hard to say what it means. So I think when people get a hit on my stuff, they may read a post, maybe even 2. But I think it would – I don't know that anybody is reading all my stuff. All my stuff there is, first, it's very extensive.
Yep.
And secondly, it's in digital form. And people don't understand digital form. That's one of the things that I'm trying to get across. But people are locked into literary form. They, as far as I can see, there's very few people understand how to do digital research.
Well, they can read your stuff, right?
Exactly.
But more is required.
Yeah, so my stuff, first of all, it's there are various classifications that are assigned to every post.
Yeah.
But you can also do a simple search or an advanced search. And it's by reading deeply through advanced search that you come to understand stuff. So just as an example, if you're doing some work on Eliot and you're reading the four quartets, which Kenner and McLuhan were doing at the end of the 1940s, and by that time McLuhan had already been reading Eliot intensely for 15 years or so.
Yeah.
So they're reading the four quartets, and If they were, I don't know that they did this, but presumably they did. If you read Little Gidding, which is the last of the four quartets, you simply can't understand it unless you read it in terms of the last of the cantos of the Divine Comedy. Right? So
yep.
That kind of exemplifies how digital research works. Digital research is inherently transparent to other stuff.
Yeah.
And as you read it in linear fashion, you have to also read it in vertical fashion to the stuff that's below.
Yes.
And there's even more stuff below than there is above.
Right. So people don't do that. You can tell.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that's what I believe. That is how Finnegan's Wake is constructed.
Yes.
That it's a surface that is transparent, and the transparency is actually built into the surface.
Yeah. Okay, so there may be, there's me and Andrew Crystal and, I don't know, maybe Clinton, three other people who have read a lot. I haven't read all of it. I haven't kept up with your latest, but I read a lot of it through many years. But I'm naming the people that you know have read a lot of it, right?
Well, I wouldn't. I don't know that Andrew or Clinton have read a lot. With Clinton, I don't think that I'm able to express to Clinton what I'm what I think McLuhan was doing,
verbally or in your writing.
Either one.
In your conversation with him, he's not getting it. You can tell.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so geez, maybe I'm the only guy who's reading it seriously. Is there anybody I wouldn't know that told you they're reading it?
Sure. Well, I have some friends that read some of my stuff, but I think my stuff probably taken in volume is like trying to eat rice without water or something. I think that I write in a way that most people will find very dry, and they'll have a hard time trying to take it in.
Yeah.
And I think myself that's it's an unfortunate thing, but it's not inexplicable. People understand things only at the right time to do it, only when they're ready to do it.
Yeah.
And so I write in a way that where I try to pack as much stuff in as I can, with a clear surface. So Joyce writes with the an unclear surface to make it somehow clear of all the stuff that he's packing in there.
Yeah.
Whereas I try to write with a clear surface that gets into the deep stuff, not in the words that I'm using, but in the stuff that's underneath it that you have to find out through digital research, namely
yeah.
through advanced search.
Right. Okay, so I'm not sure if we can say about the communication problem. You were saying that McLuhan saw something, and he sees a solution. Why couldn't he communicate? Well, why can't anybody communicate it? Or is that maybe the cul-de-sac we're in, and it's not going to be ever communicated if you have a vision of a solution?
The inability to communicate in one way does indeed define the cul-de-sac, but ultimately the cul-de-sac is only one possibility for humans. it is conceivably it's a fatal cul-de-sac. Right? Eliot says in the Four Quartets, that which is only living can only die. And that may be applicable to the whole species.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, the cul-de-sac is not the only possibility that is before, in all senses of before,
yeah.
Not the only possibility that is before humans. So humans aren't necessarily going to be drawn to the bottom of the maelstrom. They may find some possibility of getting back to the surface, as Poe's Mariner did. But how that is going to happen is the great question. It presumably is going to take place through communication of a vision. But is that possible? I don't know. Is it possible for me? I really don't know. Is it possible for you? Again, I really don't know.
Well, I am living it. Ion has, as non-physical, if you take it on face value what it's saying, has merged with the physical. And this is the great religious vision of prophets, that this merger, you could say, of heaven and earth, is happening. And two-thirds of humanity is not going to survive it, Ion says. And I'm in the middle of dealing with that right now, is what Ion says, in public and in private. But there is a solution which we are providing, which Ion makes possible. But I caused it because I accidentally evoked Ion, though sometimes when Ion's in a cheeky mood, he'll say, "You think you evoked this, Bob?" the apparent surface, it appears to be, but maybe there's larger historical forces involved. So anyways, I'm in the middle of the huge mystical vision or inspirational situation that all the greats have. Now, there are a lot of other people who are dealing with mediums and channeling. It's a fad, and you're aware of that, right?
Sure.
New Age fad. But I think that Ion's a little more solid, and especially because we make stuff, and we do, for Carolyn, her vision is actually able to treat pretty well any ailment you come up with our products. So that's a pretty exciting experience for her, and I get to watch it. And then I can claim, well, I caused this because she got it from Ion, and I brought Ion to her. So I feel that whatever drama McLuhan put himself in, thinking he had a solution, I know exactly what he's experiencing. I'm old enough to know it, and I'm in the middle of doing it. And I'm pretty sure the greats are around encouraging us. So I like to call that a megalomania. So I've definitely got a megalomania, and I brought it out of you 10 episodes or ago when we got you going to Washington and what you were going to say. Right? Remember that?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So I think you glimpse McLuhan's drama, and you're experiencing it yourself. And I'm doing it in my medium, so to speak.
Right. So the big difference between what you do and what I do is that you have a kind of faith or belief in megalomania.
Yeah.
You believe that if as McLuhan, I think, talks about in terms of the guy that the blind guy that wrote
yeah, Jacques.
There Be Light. Sorry?
Jacques.
Yeah, Leverian or Lazarian.
Lalul, or not Jacques Ellul, but yeah.
No.
Sometimes I forget.
Yeah, we know who we're talking about.
Yeah.
But at any rate, he in the course of that, I believe the guy says that when people are talking to a blind person, they think they can communicate better by talking louder.
Yes.
Right? And
yes.
McLuhan...
Lucy Rand. Jacques Lucy Rand.
Yeah. So McLuhan apparently liked that, because the rest of his life after he read that book, he always talked about how some people believe that you can communicate by talking louder.
Yeah.
And he thought that was kind of funny. But in a way, that's what you do.
I'm louder.
Talk more, how can I say, more expansively, with more dimensions.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
With more power, you could say.
Yes.
Right? And I'm taking the opposite view. I take the view that communication may happen through less.
Yes.
Through
very quiet.
That's right. That's right. And tending to be as depreciative as possible.
Right. You've heard of Captain Beefheart, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and his famous album, Troutmass Replica, he has a song, I think it's on that album, and as a Canadian, you'd get this. It's called Steal Softly Through Snow.
Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
what you do.
Yes.
Whereas he
That's
has another
I
song.
To do.
What?
That's what I attempt to do. It's
yeah.
not easy to be as little as possible.
I know, because the snow can squeak. You know, a certain kind of snow.
And leaves footprints.
Yeah. And I would say it just comes to me, okay, I'm doing Dachau Blues, which is his song about the concentration camp and the poor Jews. I am on the air with something that is saying 2/3 of humanity is not going to make it through these viruses over the next year or two, which is pretty, that's pretty loud, right? That's megalomaniac loudness.
Mm-hmm.
And he's talking about the global...
It's a very bold prediction.
Bold, yes. And McLuhan understood, he said cities were concentration camps, and he knows we've become a global concentration camp. And so it's Dachau Blues we're experiencing right now.
Maybe. I've been there. I don't know if you have.
Yeah, I've been there. Yeah.
Okay. And so you know that over the gate to Dachau is Arbeit macht frei.
Yeah, work makes free.
That's right.
Yeah.
And you could say that is the controlling thought of the modern world.
Yeah.
That when McLuhan talks about people going out to be alone, the controlling thought there is Arbeit macht frei. That is to say that the person, everybody going out has made up a persona.
Yes.
And that persona is what makes them free. That is to say that makes them independent of what anybody thinks, what anybody sees in them.
Yes.
Right? So it's people chewing gum in the 1950s.
Yeah.
It's people looking at their phone now.
Today, yeah.
When people look at their phone or chew gum, what they're saying is, I don't give a shit if you're looking at me. I already know who I am. Right? And that supposedly mocked Fry, but it doesn't. It's the exact opposite. It controls us in the cul-de-sac.
Yeah. Well said. So, okay. We're trying to get into my text here. And you're interviewing me, but you do all the talking.
Well, I'm not sure that people would say exactly that. I do some of the talking. You had quite an extensive bit of talking about Lawrence. And
yes, but that was personal stuff. It wasn't deep philosophy like you do. Okay, so we come back to this problem where I screw up in my first sentence and say the word conceptual.
Well, I don't know that it screws it up. All I would say is that it brings up deep issues that from in terms of McLuhan that we need to be clear about.
Yes.
Right? That's really a different question from how to look at Trump. So I agree that looking at Trump in what you call the amoral perceptual school is a very sort of interesting perspective.
Yep.
And it's the sort of perspective that McLuhan will come to see as Menippean.
Yes.
Right, later.
Yeah.
Not at this point in time. Once you see Trump through a Menippean perspective, then you can see him as a sort of a donkey, an ass, but as a talking ass.
Yes.
Right? As an ass that has something to say to us, but we have to understand the language of the donkey.
Yes, he's a communicating ass.
Correct. Correct.
And he has not stopped communicating. He's more prominent now than he was when he was president. He's back.
That's right.
Being interviewed.
That's right.
Yeah.
But the communicating that's going on is not the communicating that we can see from all of the press releases, and the now he's actually going to rallies and stuff like
yeah.
that. That's a communication that is, in your perspective, I believe, and also in mine, that communicates something at a deeper level. That is to say, he's doing all this communicating, and that's actually happening and actually increasing, but there's another sort of communication that's going on at a deeper level, and that's what you want to say about the Trump that nobody
yeah.
knew.
That we don't know. We don't
Correct.
See.
Yeah.
Okay, so how do we, you've clarified, what do you call it? You've made the proviso about the conceptual and the ethical. So you've explained what I'm doing. I'm going the cognitive route, and I point out that all the commentary is ethical and moral. I cite Joe Scarborough. Does he mean anything to you?
Yeah, he doesn't mean anything to me, but I know he's a host
yeah.
In the morning program, and that he's married to his partner.
Who is a daughter of Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was a reader of McLuhan.
Yeah, he was a Canadian.
Yes, Montreal, right?
That's right.
Yeah, so you have, yeah, so we have a deep state daughter and a... ex-politician asshole, Joe Scarborough, trying to talk about the other asshole, Donald Trump. And they're not doing too well. Their ratings are going down, and they don't, because they're taking the ethical view. They're not going to get anywhere. You can't beat Trump.
Yep.
Let's see. Now, you know, if I told her that, she'd say, well, I'm immoral, and that's stupid, and they'll maintain their moral stance about this horrible person, you know?
Yeah,
they can't
no question.
They can't get out of their cul-de-sac.
Oh, absolutely. That's not only a cul-de-sac that they can't get out of, it's in a certain way, it's the cul-de-sac. And you can get into it in other ways. But as I was saying earlier about Nietzsche, the bottom problem of modernity has to do with morality, has to do with the human animal that needs morality.
Yeah.
Right? So there, these people are expressing what human beings are, and what human beings are is very dangerous.
Right. Now, I partly am thinking of an interview with Richard Castellanos, New York Times, January 67. And in there, if I got it right, McLuhan says to Richard, who was a young student, early, just beginning journalist, he says, people need concepts to get a grip on reality. So I don't know what evoked that. Because it's a conversational article, not just a question-answer thing. You know, it's a
yeah.
picturesque presentation of McLuhan interacting with Castellanos. So he might have been asking, being a young baby boomer person, he's totally into literary criticism and concepts, so he's biased toward being conceptual naturally as a North American, and he's probably asking McLuhan about What are percepts? How come you say your work's not conceptual? It's perceptual. What the heck is the role of concepts, which I see you providing me is new concepts? You know, that's what the student would say. And he says, well, concepts are necessary for people to get a grip on reality. How would you analyze that statement? What is he saying? Is there something more you'd say before I say something?
No, it just in order to understand that, you would have to see more of the context.
Well, just take
so
it,
I could talk.
I remember it was quite out of context, or it just pops up. Maybe I have to look up the article for you sometime, but just saying that it stands out. He's saying, well, no, I want to hear what you say. Take it for what it is, pops out, no context. What do you think he's saying there?
Well, I think he might be saying a couple different things. One thing he might be saying is that most people in the contemporary world require concepts to understand reality, and when they employ those concepts, they oversee the percepts that have led them to those concepts.
Yeah.
So they're to that extent, their experience is blind. But he could also be sort of eliding the difference between percepts and concepts, and he may be saying that, look, there's no such thing as direct experience. There's only experience that has certain presuppositions, and we can call those presuppositions what we will, and one name for them could be concepts.
Yeah, did you say the presuppositions we have?
Yes.
That we overlay the percept.
I'm saying that the second possibility of what he might be saying is that there is no direct experience. There is no matching, so that we know truth through direction. Instead, all experience has presuppositions. All experience is indirect. It's mediated.
Yeah.
That's why media are so important. Okay, so then in this vein, he could be saying that there are many names for those presuppositions, one of which is concepts.
Right.
Right? And there concepts would be used positively, whereas in the first instance, concepts would be used negatively. And he, depending on context, he could be saying either one.
Yes. So the way I took it years ago was, knowing that he emphasized percept, whatever that meant, and played down the word concept, he was saying that because his work is presented in books, that naturally favors conceptual responses, as if one understood the difference between concept and percept, as if one thought he was saying.
Mm-hmm.
So he says, I'm writing books because I know people will interpret them conceptually, morally, ethically, and in their limitations, fall into the problem again. But at the same time, he thought books were useful in as in any environment to the electric age. He said in the 50s that he was looking for a new role for books. And I think he thought he found it. That was part of his solution, his vision, was he found a way to use books. And he would counter the natural book effect, which is people go conceptual or moral, or try to get a point of view from the book, a conclusion, and miss the dialogical, unless it was blatantly dialogical like a Socratic presentation. So he knew that's where he was expressing his cul-de-sac, right there to Richard Castellanos, that people need concepts to get a grip on reality. Unfortunately, he didn't say unfortunately there, but if the book is an anti-environment, there's a role for the conceptual misinterpretation of himself by the reader. So that's the service of the situation, which would get to your point that concept is percept in the global theater.
Can be. The one thing I would say is that when McLuhan thinks that books and the reading of books is Gutenbergian by nature, it's not because the individual reader is, or not only because the individual reader is looking at the black and white marks and following along a linear pathway. It's mostly because the whole environment is mediated. The whole environment has a certain idea about factory productivity, certain idea about children's learning, certain idea about how education works, and all of these things are directing the reading of books to Gutenbergian linearity. And that in itself has a great danger to it.
Yeah.
So what
let me say this. McLuhan said once, you don't have to read books to be Gutenbergized if you live in an industrial environment, say, 100 years
ago. Absolutely. That's right. So then, when, as you rightly say, when McLuhan sees the book as a potentially an anti-environment, when he sees the book as something that needs to be saved, what he's trying to do is say to people, and he did say this, by the way, very, very clearly, but nobody heard it, we're in a situation where the values that are prompted by the book, saved by the book, analogous to the book, all of those values are under extreme threat.
Yep.
And if you idiots out there can't see this extreme threat, then it's going to destroy you. So what we need to do is we need to see the book on the one hand as typical of what is destroying us, but on the other hand as what could save us.
Right. Right.
Namely, we need to see the book as one, as representative of one possibility amongst others, and the seeing one possibility amongst others is the only thing that can save us. So if you see the book properly, we're saved. If you see the book improperly, we're doomed.
Yeah, and he felt that the hardest book ever was the best example of the book to be read, you know, Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so. That's part of McLuhan that I don't understand, because I don't understand enough of Finnegan's Wake to understand that. But you're right that he did definitely think that and say that.
Yeah. And it was his antidote to the LSD fad among his students. He pointed out that you'll get a richer LSD experience by doing Finnegan's Wake than doing the chemical.
Uh-huh. That's right.
So it's interesting. I don't know if you need to. I think maybe you're giving a Gutenberg response to Finnegan's Wake. You think you need to be familiar with almost every page and a lot of the content to get it. Then maybe one does if you're a Gutenbergian. I don't say that. I tell people this is an example of the way literature changed due to radio and movies, 100 years ago. And so it's a bizarre world that people had stumbled into after World War One, or during the war, and you needed a strange book to show people the now that they were experiencing. And so
that's why
Finnegan's Wake is written properly, and no other book, traditionally linear, is. And if you tell that to people, I don't know how much they really deeply understand it, but it gives them a beginning point to realize, I don't have to understand every 60 languages and all that. No. Murray Schafer said that Marshall just kept telling everybody in his class that the book was not a book, it was a radio program. So
you've
got to work with that idea, figure out what it means.
Yeah, so I think what I hear you saying there, and what I think is interesting, is I hear you saying that any section of Finnegan's Wake may be taken as a hologram.
Yes.
And that every section of the book, just like a hologram, is a reproduction of the whole.
Exactly.
So there's no point. There's no point in understanding the whole.
That's right. So you don't. You could say that you understand it.
Maybe.
Yeah. See, but it's interesting,
I don't know that I understand even a small section well enough to say. But I take your point that if you know enough about some section of Finnegan's Wake, then you understand it all. By the way, some of my posts concern what I call Wakeys, namely the language of Finnegan's Wake. And if you're speaking a language, basically either you do or you don't.
Yeah.
Right? And you don't have to, let's say that you're claim to speak English, that doesn't mean that you are about to speak, you know, every sentence that has ever been spoken in English.
Right.
It simply means that you can understand somebody who's speaking English.
Which reminds me. Okay, finish that. Continue your sentence.
Well, no, just that I think that's what you're saying about Finnegan's Wake.
Right.
You can either speak some portion, in which case you can understand the relevant sense of understanding in Finnegan's Wake, or you don't.
Exactly. Zingroni wrote in his printed version of his talk at Fordham, the 98 conference, 1998, he says the McLuhanism is divided between those who think Finnegan's Wake is the key to all of McLuhan and those that don't. So I thought it was a good statement. So you're leaning towards being on the Finnegan side, but not completely yet, because don't feel you've mastered it. Well, let me see.
That's partly true, but also I don't believe that it's the key to McLuhan, because McLuhan, although he was a great fan of Joyce and thought he was one of the funniest guys that ever lived, he didn't follow Joyce in all respects.
No.
So Joyce was a great critic of the Catholic Church, and thought that if somebody were like McLuhan, sitting in a pew with some grandmothers and thinking that the grandmothers had great insight, that was something that Joyce couldn't share, didn't want to share.
Don Thiel made a lot out of this, that Marshall actually didn't like Joyce. He was a Lewis guy, and he agreed with Lewis' criticism of Joyce. And remember, he thinks Joyce is a bad a black mass. So you know of Don Thiel's objections to Marshall's faux Joycean fanship? Do you know about
I mean, I'd be interested to hear more about it, but what I do know about it, and what I understand from what you just said, I don't think is true.
Right.
I wouldn't agree with that at all.
Right, but Thiel serves to highlight it to test people about what they get from Finnegan's Wake. So let me see, where else would I say, what else would I say about that? So have you read any of Thiel's books?
Yes. I've read the two McLuhan books.
Oh, no, but you haven't read Beyond the Word and James Joyce's Technopoetics.
No.
Right. Uh-huh. Okay, so you're reading now Helix Trolysis, right?
I'm not reading it now. I read a little bit of it when we talked about it, and if at some future point we go through it in some detail, then I'll read it then.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I think you mentioned it last week. We have to go through it before you'll talk about it. But the, you know, go through it paragraph by paragraph. That book is very influenced by Don Thiel. And,
correct,
of course, you read the McLuhan statement and you thought it was silly what he was writing. Don is not a McLuhanite, so you couldn't object to what he says about Thiel because you don't know Thiel enough.
Maybe.
So, okay, so I wanted to bring up that book, and that's still on the side. So,
Let me just go back for half a second to
yeah.
the idea that McLuhan was a Lewisite and agreed with Lewis's critique of Joyce.
I don't agree
McLuhan,
with that. You know, I know what I said is wrong, but you got to use wrong statements to get at McLuhan.
But you were citing Thiel.
Yeah.
You weren't speaking in your own voice.
Right.
But
yeah.
I just want to say that I don't know that Don had that view, but if he did, I just think that's wildly mistaken. McLuhan is more critical of Lewis, I would say,
yes,
than he ever was of Joyce. And the statement about a black mass can be taken in many different ways. It's not necessarily just 100% critical of Finnegan's Wake.
No, that's right.
It can be an appreciation of Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah. So, to me, Don Thiel represents, you know, a super student of McLuhan, and look at the confusion that still comes out of it. There's
correct.
The human condition.
I agree with you completely there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the issue
and
here.
And his thesis, which covered you know, Joyce and Eliot and Pound and I think everybody but Lewis, it's way, way too wide to be useful. All of those people require a lifetime of thought.
Well, what I found useful about it was that it gave a clue of what Marshall said and what a smart student picked up. In
right.
Marshall's classes in the early 50s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah. Because I know what McLuhan said back then, and Don is saying that. And so Don is a good listener, a good mime, a good absorber of what McLuhan was doing, and some of the other people in the class said he was the brightest student of the McLuhan students. You know, some of those people in those CD-ROMs talk about Don. People who, one of them was a woman who was in the class. And she said there was a core of them that really liked McLuhan and were into him. But Don was the leader, right? And,
mm-hmm.
and the rest mm-hmm. probably got nowheres in any way. And then that's why Don was, quote, hired by Marshall to be the first assistant around him and help draft the communication seminar proposal for Ford, for the Ford
right.
grant.
Right.
So,
and was a major guy in writing up protocols for the seminar.
Yeah. So Don, and he knew this, he dedicated his life to misunderstanding McLuhan because he was pissed off at McLuhan in some way, personally.
Right. So we have to understand what's going on there. A person that sees stuff doesn't automatically communicate what is seen.
Yeah.
In fact, communication is almost impossible. And
yep.
Therefore, it's necessary to talk to people on and on and on that aren't getting what is said.
It's necessary to talk to them.
Pardon me?
You're saying it's necessary to talk to people who aren't getting it.
That's right. There's no other possibility. Right? So you talk and talk and talk and attempt communication. That's the only thing you can do but it doesn't work. Right? It never hasn't worked since Plato. So the all you can do is attempt communication, and there's nothing else to do.
Well, I proved that. I've been on the radio for 40 years, paying attention to everybody's confusion about McLuhan.
Yes, but what you've been, but in trying to communicate to that to people, I don't know that you've been successful.
I have had much enthusiasm, but I personally, privately, know they didn't get it.
Yes, they think they got it. Right. So here you are. You're saying you spent 40 years talking to people and trying to explain to people, but without communicating. And that's the great problem. So if we're thinking about McLuhan and Thiel, McLuhan has only got so many students, and only a few of them really get anything, and only a few of the few are willing to spend more and more time with McLuhan in attempt to define what's going on. So that kind of what I just said kind of describes the trajectory between McLuhan and Thiel, but you can only take that trajectory so far. If you repeatedly describe certain points to a person and they don't get it, after a while you just give up.
And I play music. I don't give up. I play music.
Yeah, but that must have happened between McLuhan and Thiel. McLuhan must have said to himself, at least, I can't continue spending all this energy on this guy. He's never going to get it.
Right.
And Thiel must have thought that, well, this shows that McLuhan's a dork, right, ultimately.
And I think McLuhan felt that about George Thompson, Barry Nevitt, and his son, Eric.
Yes, yeah.
Nobody got him to his satisfaction.
Correct. And that's not an untypical finding.
Yeah, that's right? The usual.
Yeah, that's the way it goes.
So I don't think you're an optimist. I think you think humanity's going to do themselves in because they can't get it on a mass level.
I don't think that humanity is without help, right? I would call myself a Christian, and I would say that there is a ground to history that doesn't depend upon humans achieving some level of communication with each other.
Right. So that's the act of faith that Eric likes to talk about.
Well, I don't know.
He says faith is, he's speaking as a Christian, he says faith is a percept.
Sure, well, but, you know. We're back at the start of our conversation. There's nothing that's not a percept.
Right. So he's saying nothing. He's saying nothing.
Faith is a percept. That doesn't work.
Right. Now listen to this. You know what Ion defines faith? It's self-image. Faith is self-image. What do you think of that?
I think it could be helpful.
That's perceptual more than saying the word percept that Eric does. Faith is percept says nothing. But to say faith is self-image, that's saying something. Because you can look at your image of yourself.
Yeah. I tend to understand that in terms of McLuhan's idea of going out to be alone.
Yeah.
You could say that going out to be alone is a forced self-image. And I take it what you're talking about from Ion is a self-image that is not through force.
Right.
It's a self-image that is beyond fourth.
Yes, fourth, he has a term, a phrase for it. He uses it a lot. Ian says, conditioned response. A conditioned response. That's self-image. Because you're conditioned by your environment and all that you interact with to tell you what you think you are. That's how you get your self-image.
Yeah, but I, yeah, that's... I,
too
that's,
glib?
That, well, too I mean, glib. It's... I don't know about that, but I do know that it's not obvious how you go from there to faith.
Right. Well, but you're communicating faith in a normal way, what we understand Christians have. You know, you think that something will save humanity, or some of humanity.
Well, I just, saving is a very complicated matter.
Yeah.
Right? So Christians talk about being saved. That has nothing to do with whether or not the world is going to be saved.
Right.
So saving is a very complicated matter. How and if it might occur sort of at large for the world, I don't claim to know. I have hopes, and I attempt to do what little I can do to try to illuminate the conditions that may have something to do with that. But then how that general saving or lack of saving, how that relates to individuals being saved, that's a whole different question.
Well, I don't think you really believe that the species will wipe itself out completely.
I don't think that's a matter of belief. I think it's certainly a possibility. And to me, the worrisome thing is that so many other beings, animal beings and plant beings, and the being of past people that did so much in terms of culture, but also just in terms of normal life. All of this past being, animal being, plant being, basically depends upon our straightening ourselves out. That's a very bleak prospect. if we wipe ourselves out, we wipe out all that other stuff.
Right. So, I might take the tack that you're emphasizing the cul-de-sac too much.
Maybe.
Now, McLuhan, he says that not understanding, you know, not matching is normal in human communication. He's quite relaxed about it. That's another factor, is to be relaxed about the confusion that humans have.
Yeah, but wait a sec. Don't say not matching is confusion.
No.
Matching is confusion for McLuhan.
Yes, yes. You're not matching. You think you are, but you're not. Matching is very difficult.
But it's not what... Well, matching is not difficult. It's impossible.
Okay. Right. But people think they are matching.
There is no such thing as matching because of the nature of language, because everything is mediated.
And the ethical view, that's the cognitive view, the ethical view is that people think they're matching.
Correct. And want to match and believe in matching and associate morality with matching, et cetera, et cetera. Sure. But that's not what you said. Was not matching is confusion. But for McLuhan, the not matching, which you can see in art or music or Shakespeare or Plato, that it's through understanding of not matching.
Well, I know.
That we're going.
I was tentative in what I said, and as McLuhan would say, I may have got that backwards. But I was tentative because I wasn't sure if you could match it all with what I was trying to say.
Right.
Anyway, I think that's a good point. We've come to this key terminology, matching and making, McLuhan, and that's a beginning point of any survey of McLuhan. You got to begin with that. So I'm sure I do in the beginning pages here. So let's try to get into the text. Though, I do want to mention this. There's this book that I mentioned in 2017, Unshackled, The Dustbin of Donald Trump. And it's a collection of pop culture images and movies, music, books, say from the 50s on, and how that American archetype of these odd people anticipated Trump. He was the consolidation of the archetype. I recommend that book to you. It's a very small book.
Okay, and written by who?
Scott Woods and Phil somebody. Here it is. Well, look, right on the bottom of page 5 is the link to it on Amazon.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I see that.
Yeah, Phil Delio. I know Scott Woods. I don't know Phil Delio. Me and Dave Neufeld, who made the McLuhan albums, are acknowledged by Scott and Phil as inspirations for the book. Our talk about Trump years ago. And this is a Toronto person, Scott, who hates Trump. He almost doesn't realize the value of this book. But I'd be very interested in your reaction to the images they get from pop culture to show the composite that makes up Donald Trump.
Yeah. That's right. It's like Charlie Chaplin in that sense.
Yes.
Right? I haven't read the book, but from what you're saying, just as Chaplin kind of personifies a whole series of people from society over the 30 or 40 years before his movies, I can see that Trump might be seen in the same way as a kind of the culminating archetype of all of these weirdos.
Yeah, of what Ion says is the Larry Flint archetype of fuck you. I'm a millionaire now, and I don't have to listen to you.
That's an interesting thought.
Yeah.
But you know what we should do? I see it's 7:30.
Yeah, we got to end.
Yeah, we'll end, but that's a very good place to start again.
Yeah.
Because we've come to making and matching. We've come to big questions that are involved in your text. And what we need to do is get back to your text and get away from all our sidebars that are lasting for the whole interview.
Right. See if I don't know if it's on Kindle. Probably is. Get the book. And it's an easy read, very interesting. That's your assignment. Try to read this book before next Thursday.
I'll see what I can do.
Yeah.
I got lots of other assignments, but I'll see if I can do it.
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll just have one require a couple of weeks, but buy it.
Yeah.
Definitely need to buy it.
Okay.
It's an example of me finding something very obscure that I find really useful.
Yeah, but it's not that obscure to you. You know one of the authors.
Yes, but nobody else does. I don't think anybody bought their book.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Again, great talking to you, Cameron. And
yes, sir.
Very good
talk to you
concept.
Next week, Bob. Look forward.
Yeah, you hooked up a lot of good concepts there.
Okay.
Okay. Talk to you later.
Talk to you later.
Yeah,
bye.